Today's sutta is called the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, Two Kinds of Thought. And it's a sutta that I have been reading quite a bit recently. As always, when you start reading the suttas and you look into them, there's always a lot of stuff there which usually you can't see initially. And sometimes it takes a lot of rereadings before you see some of the details of this sutta. And the same thing is true of this one. And there are many things in here which I certainly now, after having read it many times, I find quite interesting. So usually, if I find a sutta I find interesting, I also find it more interesting to teach from that sutta, because then my interest is more aroused. Anyway, so this is the Two Kinds of Thought, Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, and it goes as follows. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So here these two classes, obviously, are, on the one hand, they are like the defiled thinking, sensual desire, ill will. And the third one here, cruelty, is actually vihingsa in Pali. And it means probably more like harming or even callousness towards other beings, not really being compassionate and understanding, rather than cruelty. I think harming is the latest translation that Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi uses for this word. So these are the defiled states of mind on the one side. And on the other side, he has the thoughts of renunciation. Now, renunciation is the opposite of sensual desire. So it's like the giving up of sensual desire. That is what is meant by renunciation in the suttas. And then non-ill will and non-harming. Why is it called non-ill will? Why isn't it called metta, for example? Why isn't it called compassion rather than non-harming? The answer, I think, is that the reason it's called non-ill will is because the states that are not to do with ill will are broader than just metta. Metta, of course, is the most important aspect of non-ill will. It's the aspect that helps you overcome ill will by practicing metta. But it's actually broader than that. For example, if you have true equanimity of mind, that's also non-ill will. So it is broader than simply metta, and that's why I think this particular terminology is used. And the same thing with non-cruelty. The normal opposite of non-cruelty or non-harming would be compassion, having a concern for the welfare of others. But because it's broader than that, that's why it's called non-cruelty rather than compassion. These Buddha's teachings are quite precise usually, and that's why they use this kind of terminology, which may seem strange initially, but once you understand the broader picture, you can see why it is used in this way. Okay, so that's what the Buddha... So now he's talking about before his awakening, while he was a bodhisattva. And you will find in the suttas, the time when the Buddha calls himself a bodhisattva is always in the same life that he attained awakening. It never refers to past lives. It always refers to the same life, the time of his life before he attained awakening. Okay, so then he goes on. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I consider this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. Okay, so initially, the Buddha starts off by saying, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Now, the Pali word for diligent here is appamada, which I think is better translated as heedful. So as I abided, thus heedful. And I think heedful to me is a more meaningful word in the Dhamma context than diligent. Diligent is more like somebody who works hard or whatever. Heedful means you are careful, you are wise, you are circumspect. You don't actually believe things easily, but you look at things carefully, you consider them carefully. Heedful to me has this much, much more kind of Dhamma or spiritual qualities to it than diligent. Diligent may have that, but not necessarily. And the other word here is ardent, is atapi. Atapi basically means that you have energy, you're energetic. So I prefer that to ardent. Ardent to me sounds, again, maybe too much striving. And the last one here, resolute, pahitatta, I think maybe resolute maybe not be such a bad translation. But what is interesting here, it says, as I abided thus. So it refers back to the previous text, right? What does it mean to be heedful, energetic, and resolute? It means that you divide your thoughts into two classes. That's what it means. Because as I abided thus refers back to the dividing of the thoughts into two classes. In other words, what is meant here is not that you're putting forth a lot of striving or energy. What is meant is that you are wise about your circumstances, that you're careful, that you consider things carefully. And that is what is meant here by these words. Which is important because sometimes when you read the English translation, even when you read the Pali, you think that you see the meaning of this word. You think, oh yeah, here I must strive. This is obviously what it means here. Then when you consider the context, it actually means something different. It actually refers to wisdom rather than striving. And that's what you see here when you look at this more carefully. And that is important because these words, appamada, atapi, and pahitatta, they occur often in the suttas. So when they occur in other places, you know that there too, they are likely to refer to wisdom rather than to necessarily a lot of intense striving, like tormenting the body or whatever it is. Of course, there's always a degree of effort involved, even if you want to be wise. You have to think, you have to reflect, you have to consider things. There is some degree of effort involved in all that, but it's not the kind of ascetic endeavor that sometimes people think spiritual life is about. So, as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood this. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Again, here you see the Buddha here as a fairly ordinary person. He has a thought of sensual desire. May not be very gross thoughts of sensual desire, but at least there is some aspect of sensual desire there. Again, you can recognize the Buddha as an ordinary human being. He's just like us. And of course, that's why he's teaching the sutta, because the point of the sutta is to be an example on how we should practice. If this is what the Buddha did before his awakening, we should do exactly the same before our awakening. We have to practice in the same way. That's obviously the point here. And by saying this, he's saying basically we are on the same level. Whether you're the Buddha or you're any other person, the problems are the same that we have to overcome. It's very useful to remember that because sometimes it is easy to have too much respect, too much reverence, and that is also not good. You have to find that balance there. So the first thing then, I understood that the thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. And this understanding is not a very simple thing because understanding this means the full understanding of what sensual desire is all about. It means understanding sensual desire when it is at its strongest, all the way to its very weakest manifestation. The whole thing you have to understand. It sounds easy when you read it like that. I understood it. I have thought of sensual desire, but actually it's very difficult to know that, because only when the mind becomes very peaceful and you almost have overcome sensual desire completely can you know the very refined aspects of this defilement. So this is already a very hard thing to do, and this is what you're trying to do more than anything in the Satipatthana, in the Dhammanupassana, the last quarter of the Satipatthana Sutta, is about contemplating the five hindrances, understanding how they arise, what they are, how they're abandoned, all these kind of things. So it comes in there. But it's not an easy as it may seem at first sight. So it is about understanding the full depth of sensual desire, from the most refined to the most coarse, and also the full breadth, of course. What are the six senses, all the various types of sensual desire that are available, etc. The full breadth and the full depth of these things. So when the Buddha says here, I understood this, he would mean that he really understood every aspect of sensual desire. And then when he understood that the thought of sensual desire has arisen, the next thought he has is, this leads to my own affliction, to my own suffering, right? To others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. It leads to my own affliction. Now, the next two paragraphs further down are about ill will and harming, and it's maybe easier to understand how ill will and harming lead to one's own affliction, because it doesn't feel good. Often when you have ill will and anger, you will say things and do things you don't really want to do. And of course that, you have remorse afterwards because of these things, then you create bad karma. And of course that may have very bad effects in the future life. And all of these things are part of this thing when we say it leads to my own affliction. So this is obviously a very important reflection here, because just afterwards the Buddha says, when I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. In other words, he was able to abandon the sensual desire simply by the reflection, this leads to my own affliction. So it's a very powerful reflection. It's a very, very powerful reflection. And you'll see here the Buddha doesn't use any force to abandon the defilements. He doesn't say, I will suppress this use willpower to beat it down or whatever. What he says, I will use wisdom power. I will understand fully that this leads to my own affliction, and that is how I will overcome the sensual desire. Very powerful and very useful to see how he actually goes about overcoming these defilements. And to be able to do this, and this is of course the hard part, you have to reflect on sensual desire. You have to reflect on the dangers of sensual desire. Even more so, you have to reflect on the dangers of ill will and harming further down, because these are even worse defilements. You have to really understand thoroughly why it actually does lead to your own suffering in the long run. The more you reflect on that, the more clear that is in your mind, the more powerful will be your ability to abolish that thought whenever it arises, simply by bringing that reflection back up into your mind, and it will abolish the whole thing. That's how powerful it is. So very, very useful and very powerful. And when that happens, the thought just disappears, as you will see later on in this paragraph. And of course, then you think in the same way about others' affliction. That's also often, sometimes it can be easy for some people to think of others. So if you know that this leads to others' affliction, you know that anger can only be restrained so far, even desire can only be restrained so far, sooner or later you will do something or say something that is not right. That's the kind of the end result usually of defilements. And because of that, it will lead to the affliction of others. And again, you have to develop that perception, develop that thought, develop that wisdom, understanding to the maximum, so that when anger arises, all you need to do is quickly to remind yourself, this is dangerous, and bang, it stops straight away. And then lastly, you have, it leads to the affliction of both. And I think the reason why they have both there, we have already talked about one's own affliction and the affliction of others, so what's the point of having both? I think the reason is, Sometimes people think, oh, you know, this sensual desire is good, might be bad for others, but it's good for me, so, you know, it's okay. Or I might be able to help somebody else, so even though it's, you know, it leads to my own affliction, then because I help somebody else, it's all right. But actually, it leads to affliction of both at the same time. So just to make it clear that there isn't any one or the other. Yes, sorry.
Can I just understand here that she's using wisdom power, right?
Hmm.
But I do understand that there are other suttas where the Buddha will say that, you know, when the defilements are really strong, do use the force.
Okay.
And even the tongue press against the palate.
Exert
the muscle.
Yeah. Hmm.
But of course, that is the very last reason. I didn't find that really useful.
Yeah, that's the thing, and this is actually the sutta which comes after this one, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the calming of thought, and it gives you five ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts. And the first way is if a bad thought arises, you just think of something good instead. So if I think something bad about Huitong, I would never do that, but if I did, if I did that, then straight away I remember, I say, okay, Huitong is a good person. He keeps five precepts. He's kind-hearted. All these kind of things, and straight away I abolish that negative thought by reminding myself of the good qualities, right? And you can do this with anybody. Yeah? You can just remind yourself of the good qualities. And the second way described there is to use wisdom, to remind yourself of the suffering inherent in these things. The third way is to forget the thought. In other words, don't pay any attention to it. You know, go back to whatever you're doing, don't pay attention. The fourth way is to just, I understand the fourth way just as a passive observance of the thought and allowing it to die down, not giving any fuel to it. And only the fifth way here is the suppression, with a, you know, tongue pressed against the palate of the mouth and the teeth clenched together and you know, sweat pouring down or whatever. Yeah. It's the fifth way. And the Buddha says that it's the first way here, which is to be done first. And if that doesn't work, then you do the second way, all the way down to the fifth. But the fifth is like a last resort. If you're completely desperate, and there's nothing else you can do, and you're about to commit some horrible crime or something because of your defilements, okay, this is the time to really,
so
really go for it.
Finally, just walk away.
Yeah.
Because I find that very often is like the mind will justify that objective is important. You can do that. You know, you can give in.
Yeah.
To achieve some aim, you know, worldly aim. You know.
Right. You mean not do what is right, I mean?
Just give in to anger, you know, because the anger produces that kind of energy and people will listen, you know, bang the table and the whole team will listen, you know.
Yeah. And that is, you know, but a person like that who thinks that anger is okay, they're not going to use the last method, you know, of suppressing anything. They won't even try the first one, you know, so they're just going to be hopeless case anyway. But that is true. That is one of the very few places in the suttas where it very clearly talks about using willpower and suppressing it. I think that's the only place that I'm aware of. And it's the very last resort. And sometimes people use that resort first rather than last. You know, sometimes in daily life you see a thought in your mind and you think, oh no, I can't think like that. You know, you feel almost embarrassed about your thought. And you crush it down. But that is actually not the right way here. So,
What about walking? Just walk away.
Yeah, great. Good. Yeah. Walk away. Yeah. Okay. So, So this then is what the Buddha is saying. It's basically using, again, the wisdom power. And the next thing here is it obstructs wisdom. Obstructs wisdom. Wisdom is panya here. Obstruct is, the word for obstruct here is nirodhika, which is derived from nirodha, which means cease. Basically, it causes wisdom to cease. So whenever you have a kind of sensual desire, of course, anger and ill will and harming as well, it ceases wisdom. You don't see clearly anymore. Your mind is distorted. You see through a lens which is not clear, like foggy. And because of that, it actually destroys wisdom. Again, it's a very useful reflection, because people, why? Everybody wants to be wise. Wise is such a wonderful thing, to be wise. If you're wise, it means you understand the world, you understand how things work, You understand how to be kind and a good person. You understand what leads to happiness, what leads to suffering. Yeah. So wisdom is such a wonderful thing here. So why would you want to obstruct wisdom? It causes difficulties. This basically seems to mean that it is painful, basically. These, particularly anger and also harming, but also sensual desire. If you understand what they do to your mind, if you see the kind of burning sensation, the restlessness and all the negative things that arises because of these things, then you see actually isn't a very unpleasant thing. And that is what I think is meant by difficulties. Vigata is the Pali, and it means more like harm than difficulties, really. Yeah. And then it leads away from Nibbana. And you might ask, wonder, how can this is the Bodhisattva right here, how does he know what Nibbana is? And I think what we are dealing with here is a Nibbana in the kind of pre-awakening meaning of the word. And the pre-awakening meaning is just like extinguishment in general, extinguishment of suffering in particular. Remember, the Buddha is he is out there searching for the ending of suffering, searching for the end of death, of birth, of defilements. That's what he sets out to do when he leaves the household life. So that is what I think he means by Nibbana here, the ending of these problems that he's searching for. So it leads away from that, and he's searching for the ending of death. So if it leads away from that, then clearly he has to abandon these things because it's going in the opposite direction of what he wants to. And again, when he considers all these things, it subsided in me. So the point here is that these reflections, when properly done, when properly built up over a long period of time, they are very powerful, and they have the ability to make these thoughts subside completely, disappear altogether. And then the last sentence says, whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. These words are sometimes translated even more strongly, like obliterated, I obliterated it. And again, if you don't know what is going on, unless you had this kind of passage, you would have thought, surely, obliterate, removing, do away with all these things. Surely, again, there's a lot of willpower involved in this kind of thing. Yeah. That's what people often think. Yeah. So here, what you actually see, no, it's not willpower at all. It's actually wisdom power, as Ajahn Brahm likes to say. Yeah. It's wisdom that obliterates these things. It's wisdom that abandons them. And the reason why such strong words are used in relation to wisdom is that when wisdom works, it has the power to literally obliterate that thought straight on the spot, because it cannot stand basically the light of wisdom. When you see things rightly, it just turns things around like that and is gone. So that is what is meant by these strong words. They're actually it's actually more about wisdom than willpower. And again, you wouldn't know that unless you had a very clear paragraph like this. There are many other places in the suttas where these precise words are used, sometimes translated as obliterated, sometimes as annihilated, and you don't have the context which clearly shows you that it's about wisdom power. So because you don't have the context, people tend to think that it's about using willpower. So, there you are. Very lot of information in that little paragraph there. Very, very important to my mind anyway, when I see the content of that paragraph. And then the next two paragraphs, 4 and 5, they are exactly the same, except that this time it's about ill will and harming. So as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, etc. A thought of harming arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ill will, this thought of harming has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I consider thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of harming arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So again, it's all about wisdom, not about willpower. Okay, then I will skip one paragraph and go to paragraph 7. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So the simile here is about the cowherd who is afraid to get punished if his cows eat the crop of the fields. And you can see here he's afraid of being flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed. So strong, quite strong terms. Being flogged doesn't sound very nice. Imprisoned. So, of course, the point here is that this is an equivalent to having an unwholesome state of mind. And having an unwholesome state of mind is like being flogged, basically. It's like being imprisoned. And this is the point. In the long run, it would in fact lead to much more suffering than being flogged and imprisoned. As you travel around from birth to birth, go around from birth to birth and experience whatever birth happens as a result of not having overcome these things. So he guards, he has an active attitude on the mind. He looks at the mind and makes sure that he taps it this way, taps it that way, to make sure it doesn't actually become too unwholesome. So he saw in unwholesome states the danger, in other words, the potential suffering, right? That's what it means by danger here. Degradation. I think the meaning here is simply that if you have an unwholesome state of mind, sometimes you feel like you feel bad about it. It doesn't feel good. It feels like you're impure almost. It doesn't feel nice. Whereas when this mind is very pure, the mind is very at peace, you feel that this is pure, this is beautiful. Whereas the mind which is angry or negative or has some kind of powerful desire or whatever, there is a sense of impurity there. It doesn't feel quite right. It doesn't feel quite good. And you know that. And defilement. Defilement simply because it blocks the further development. And then the opposite for the wholesome states. They clean up the mind and they have the blessing of renunciation. You're giving these things up. The reason why I read this paragraph first is because in the Chinese Agama version of this sutta, that simile comes after paragraph 5 in the Pali here. And that makes better sense to me because it fits quite well in with that one. And then comes paragraph 6. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of harming, he has abandoned the thought of non-harming to cultivate the thought of harming, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of harming. So this shows you that one of the problems with the thinking process is that we think habitually. We think in certain ways, and once you get locked into a certain pattern, the pattern tends to repeat itself all the time. And of course, that is dangerous because you know that whatever thinking pattern you have now, you will tend to take it with you into the future, into the rest of your life, into future lives. And the reason why you have the thinking patterns you have now in the first place is because very likely you have them taken them with you from past lives. So the pattern goes along, brings along, you take them along with you. This is, of course, a very important aspect of rebirth and personality, that personality is, to some extent, sticky. It tends to continue on from life to life. Who you are now is who you're going to be in the future life unless you try to make a change. That is why it is so important to take the opportunity when you have it. The opportunity is now. You don't take it now, then you will have to suffer bring these things along with you into the future. Who knows when next time comes around and you have a chance to abandon these things. This is really the opportunity. So you've got to do it now. Otherwise, you will be stuck with these unpleasant habits for a long time. So we have habits, we have inclinations, and that is one of the problems. That is also why it is difficult to change, right? Because of a habit, because of a certain way of looking at the world, a certain way of thinking, that is difficult to change. And that is why it's such hard work sometimes to actually change ourselves, to get more compassion, more metta, more equanimity, not to be angry so easy. We all know what it's like. There are certain situations that make us upset. And how difficult isn't it to try to get out of those situations, look at those situations differently, not allow us to be upset. Sometimes it's so hard. Why do we become upset? Because of habits, because of inclinations of the mind. That's why we have to change. That's why we do things like metta meditation. That's why we, you work on your perceptions. You try to look at things differently from a new angle. And this is the kind of work we all have to do individually according to our own makeup or characteristics. Okay, so whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon. So if you are used to thinking in terms of sensual desire, if you're used to having a lot of desire, you will take that with you into the future unless you do make a change. And the same is true with anger and ill will. Yeah, it's all in there. And then we come down to paragraph 8, and now we are seeing the reverse side of what we have been talking about. As I abided thus, diligent, or rather heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. So here we have the opposite kind of thoughts. The Buddha has been developing the opposite kind, or the Bodhisattva, the opposite kind of thoughts. Thoughts of renunciation, thoughts about giving up sensual desire, thoughts about the delightfulness of not having any kind of craving in the sensual world and saying, wow, this is beautiful. Let me continue to abandon these things all the time. The understanding that these things are pain. These are the thoughts of renunciation. And he understands that this thought does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. There is no harm that comes from these things. It only leads to happiness. The karmic results are happy. The way I interact with people in daily life, if I have thoughts of renunciation, are going to lead to happiness because I will treat people in the right way. My mind won't be distorted, and I won't see things in a clouded sense. I will see things clearly, so I will be able to react in a good way, and also help others and help myself. So it does not lead to affliction of anybody, nor the affliction of both. It aids wisdom. Panya vuddhika. Vuddha means to increase. It literally increases wisdom. And again, this is because, as you see several places in the suttas, that the hindrances are what block wisdom, according to Buddhism. So, whereby if you remove those hindrances, you see clearly for the first time. So wisdom becomes possible. And if you keep those hindrances at bay long enough, eventually you will make that breakthrough in the Dhamma and see things exactly as they are. And you become a stream enter, or eventually even higher up that the ladder of enlightenment stages. So it increases wisdom. Does not cause difficult, is not painful, it doesn't cause harm in the mind, you don't feel any harm in the mind. And it leads to nibbana, in other words, it leads to the sense of peace, to the extinguishment of suffering. There is less suffering in this day than there is in the states where there is defilements. So this is the opposite. So again, you need to cultivate both sides of the equation, both the idea that the defilements are painful and dangerous, and on the other hand, that the pure states are non-dangerous, actually beneficial, and lead towards awakening. Yeah. But then he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. In other words, there's no danger connected with this thought. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. And we know that it's interesting here that the body becomes tired rather than the mind becomes tired. And I think this just means that when you do think a lot, sometimes you need to go to sleep because you are tired. It's not just the mind being distracted or dull. It's actually your whole physical organism needs sleep sometimes if you think a lot. And you know, sometimes if you are very upset about something and you think obsessively, eventually it can make you very, very tired, that kind of thought. So thinking makes you tired. And when the body is tired, because the body is not tranquil, tranquility of the body is one of the factors that lead to samadhi. Because the body is not tranquil, the mind also is disturbed by that disturbance in the body because of the close connection, obviously, between the two. And because the mind is disturbed, you are not anywhere near concentration. That is the danger here. So, I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Brought it to singleness is ekodibhuta, I think, in the Pali. So this basically here is basically referring to the jhana states. That's what this is about, or at least very close. And of course, this is the first time when you are actually resting the mind. This is the states of rest, where the mind finds peace, where there's no longer moving around, is completely still. And for the first time in your life, you're really, really resting. There's no sense of agitation or disturbance at all anymore. So the point of this paragraph is simply to say that, okay, you abandon the unwholesome states using the wholesome thoughts, but once you have abandoned the unwholesome thoughts using the wholesome ones, there's no point in just keeping thinking about those wholesome things. The only purpose of the wholesome thoughts is to abandon the bad ones. They have no purpose beyond that. Once you have done that, then you move on to the meditation again. So you don't sort of sit around thinking wholesome thoughts all the time. Then you move on to the meditation. So this is the point here of this paragraph. So it's a stage, step-by-step procedure, if you like. And then the Buddha goes on about the same thing with anger and harming. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic and resolute, a thought of non-ill will, or if you like, metta, or some such high state of mind, a thought of metta arose in me, a thought of non-harming or compassion arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of non-harming and non-ill will has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So my mind should not be disturbed. So the same thing again. I just want to comment briefly on this word concentration that is often used. And of course, it does not mean concentration in the sense that we often talk about concentration. We talk about forcing the mind onto something. I'm concentrating on reading this, or concentrating on writing a report or whatever. It's not that forceful concentration. It's basically more like the mind unifying, coming together. Yes, sir.
That the Buddha actually entered jhana?
Yes, around this state, yes. This point, roughly around this point.
So it's not as if he entered the jhana once and entered first straight away into the first jhana and gained enlightenment that night?
I don't think so. I think that what you see in those suttas is basically a contraction of what happened. So it says he entered the jhanas and then he recollected the past lives and gained full awakening. I think that's a contraction. And I think probably this all happened over quite a long period of time. That's what I think. You read things like the, what should I call it? Upaklesa Sutta, Majjhima 127. And there the Buddha goes through all these defilements that he's overcoming, right? He's talking about, he's speaking to Anuruddha, Kimbila, and Nandiya. And he asked them, have you got any attainments? Have you actually achieved anything on the path? And they say, oh, we have this vision of lights. We see these forms. And then the Buddha says, but we don't know what to do next. And the Buddha says, I had the same thing when I was meditating before my awakening here. And I reflected thus, what is the problem here? And then I realized the problem was A, B, C, D, all these things, too much energy, too much tiredness, all these things which stopped my attainment. So obviously the Buddha did a lot of reflection, a lot of contemplation and meditation before he got to that point.
But I wonder when he instructed Anuruddha that way, whether it's just out of compassion, because when he was just a young boy, he could just enter the first jhana just like that, without any seeming difficulties. But in that sutta, he talked about so many obstacles, and he had to understand them in full and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And maintain the nimitta and so on, and getting in. So,
I think the thing is that as a child, it may have been like a piece of luck, basically. He was just sitting there, he was a young child, very innocent, sitting on the tree, nothing to do, and just sort of relaxing. And then suddenly things happen by themselves, But then later on, when you actually try to do that at will, it's a very different thing. The reason it happens naturally is precisely because you're not doing anything. You're not trying very hard. Once you start trying, the trying starts to get in the way. All kind of problems arise. And you find this is one of the things with meditation practice. People have some kind of experience. They think, wow, this is amazing, this is wonderful. And it is amazing and wonderful. And then they can't do it again, right? And they, oh, no, I can't do it again. And this is the problem. The willpower, the craving, trying, all that gets in the way here. And I'm sure the Buddha, even though he was, obviously very gifted, he would have been faced with the same kind of problems that everybody else is.
So he's not born holy.
Right, he's not born, no, exactly. He is born with defilements, just like us. Yeah. Yes, John.
In a previous sutta, the Buddha as Jodipada, he trained under the previous Buddha in a previous life.
Yeah.
So therefore he would have had instructions in the meditation and probably getting into the jhanas. So he would have taken that with him to this life, wouldn't it?
Yeah. That it may well be the case. The thing is that the story about the Buddha in his past life, Jotipala, and all that, there's not hardly any information at all. You don't really know what happened in that life, It's all, okay, it looks like he was ordained on the previous Buddha, but it's a long time ago, in the meantime, he may have forgotten about the jhanas. But even if he did attain the jhanas at that time, just the time span in between, and the fact that he was now reborn in a different situation, he may still have been struggling to actually reattain them in this life. It may not have happened automatically. And in fact, it may be that the very fact that he did attain it as a child under the rose apple tree may precisely have been due to the fact that he had them in the past life, as you're saying here. Yeah. Anyway, so, Okay. So he concentrates his mind, and then And then we have the simile again. I'll go through the simile first of all. This is paragraph 12. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the village, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. So you can relax a little bit. You don't have to be so vigilant anymore about your mind state. You can just sit back and observe. And as long as the states are there, there's nothing at all that you have to do, either through wisdom or willpower or anything else. So you can just stand back and relax. Yeah, so you can also see here, all he had to do was to be mindful that those states were there. So here we can see the mindfulness is coming into, kind of becoming stronger. At this point, mindfulness is becoming very sharp. And of course, the reason why mindfulness is becoming sharp is precisely because the defilements are being abandoned. That's the reason why this is happening. Yeah, that is a very important part of the sutta. This is basically what the sutta is saying. I'll talk more about that later on. And then we have the same thing about the habit of the mind. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he will abandon the thought of sensual desire to cultivate a thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon faults of non-harming, he has abandoned the thought of harming to cultivate the thought of non-harming, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of non-harming. So the same principle again, the idea that the mind gets cultivated, it has a certain momentum, and that momentum tends to carry on. So you need to develop the mind, you need to change your habits, change the way you look at things. And this is what happens when you do things like metta meditation, etc. You actually change the habit of the mind. And it is, again, hard work sometimes, but it is, in my opinion, it's one of the only things really, really worthwhile doing in life, because it actually changes your it changes your life in a real way, not in a superficial way. Anyway, so then it goes on to number 13, and it says, tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. So this is what happens when you abandon the negative states of mind. The first thing you will see here is that unremitting mindfulness was established. In other words, mindfulness became stable, and it wasn't wavering anymore. It became, it was there all the time. And energy was aroused. Energy often comes together with mindfulness. When mindfulness is sharp, you also have energy. This energy is the natural energy that arises in the mind due to the overcoming of the defilements. It's not effort, it's not trying, it's the natural energy, the luminosity inside of the mind. So you get mindfulness and energy coming together at this point. And the important thing here of the sutta, which to me has been so... makes so much sense also in connection with the other aspects of the Dhamma, is that mindfulness is established here as a consequence of overcoming the defilements. That is what this is saying, and that is the important thing here. Mindfulness comes as a consequence of that. People often forget, they don't really understand what the causality of mindfulness is. Why does mindfulness become established? Sometimes people think, oh, I just go on a retreat and I stay on the retreat long enough and mindfulness will arise. There is some truth to that. Of course, when you go on a long retreat, it will aid mindfulness to some extent. But as long as you have defilements in the mind, mindfulness will never be established fully. So this is, if you really want to have good mindfulness, if you really want your meditation to work, and meditation cannot work unless mindfulness is really well established, the only way is to actually overcome the defilements, to really understand that these are a problem and you have to overcome them if meditation really is going to take off. So overcome defilements, then you have mindfulness. When you have mindfulness, then meditation takes off. You read the Anapanasati Sutta, you read the Satipatthana Sutta, and both of those suttas say at the beginning, mindfulness is established. That's kind of the prerequisite for those suttas to work. So if you're really going to do Anapanasati, if you're really going to do Satipatthana practice, it can only happen at this stage when mindfulness is established through abandoning the hindrances, abandoning the defilements of the mind. So this is the way, and I find this so important and so interesting, because people talk about mindfulness in so many ways, but very often they don't talk enough about the causes for the arising of mindfulness. So when mindfulness arises and then you start to meditate, then you go through this process which happens in meditation, and that's what you're seeing afterwards. The tireless energy and the mindfulness, they often come together with the piti, the happiness. The body becomes tranquil. This is the pasadi. This is as the meditation deepens. You go through these things stage by stage. The body becomes tranquil. And then, through that tranquility, the mind then becomes concentrated and unified. And that is where you get to things like the stages of jhana. And that's why the next thing here is the four jhanas are then described next. And then after the four jhanas, I won't go into those now, then you have the three direct knowledges. And you see here again, the three direct knowledges, paragraph 23. Birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of existence. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, true knowledge arose, darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides heedful, energetic, and resolute. So here again you have this passage here on light arising, right? So light arises because ignorance is being banished. It's the kind of the darkness of ignorance which is banished. Now this passage here doesn't only come with the destruction of the defilements of arahatship, it also comes with previously seeing the past lives and understanding the law of karma. So when you see your past lives, then ignorance is banished, true knowledge arose, darkness is banished, and light arose. So seeing your past lives that's exactly what happens when you see your past lives. Light arising, suddenly you understand the nature of the problem. It is one, I think it is important to distinguish between having faith or confidence that there is such a thing in rebirth and actually seeing it. Many Buddhists will say that they have faith in rebirth, yeah, I believe in rebirth, but very often it doesn't do very much to them. Sometimes whether you have faith or don't have faith in rebirth doesn't make that much difference because it doesn't go very deep. So you may have faith, but then because you haven't really internalized it, really understood what it means, actually it doesn't make that much difference, and you might as well not believe in rebirth. And that is why this is so powerful, because once you see it for yourself, that is when it really becomes internalized 100% for the first time. And that is when this vision becomes, whoa, okay, there is something serious going on there, something very powerful going on. And that is why that is actually required, or certainly is required for the Buddha, before he's able to turn his mind to the full awakening. Because that sight, that understanding is just so, so powerful. Of course, it's useful to develop the reflection of samsara and of rebirths going around. It's helpful to do that, because the more you get your mind around that, the more you understand the nature of true suffering. Yeah. But I think it's the full insight which is the really powerful one. Yeah. And that's why light arises. Okay, so that is that. And then we have a beautiful simile at the end of the sutta. And the Buddha goes as follows, says as follows. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared, desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage. And he closed off the safe and good path that led to the happiness. And he opened up a false path. And he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another man came, desiring their good welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Bhikkhus, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasure. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path. That is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good welfare and protection is a term for the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path that led to the happiness is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, this simile, there's a great low-lying marsh is the term for sensual pleasures. And it's a marsh, I guess, because you get stuck there perhaps, because it's wet and boggy, marshes are usually considered unpleasant, right? And it's low-lying. The reason it's low-lying is because there are higher states that are more lofty and much more happy than sensual pleasures. So you get stuck in sensual pleasures. There isn't really that much happiness in the first place. So that's why it's called a low-lying marsh, I think. And again, it is in comparison to the deep pleasures of meditation. That's why it's called low-lying marsh. A large herd of deer is a term for beings. And when I think of this, I think of, a herd of deer. You've probably seen this sometimes on television. You have a herd of large herd of deer, maybe 1,000 deer, whatever, and they roam around, running together, and they go this way, and they go that way, and they sway, and maybe they hear a sound, so they move that way. The wind blows, they go a different way. The leader takes one direction, so they go again. They seem like this random movement, like this kind of movement of the herd of deer. And I think that is a bit like, the idea is that just like deer sort of move randomly without any kind of clear sense of direction or actually going anywhere, beings are like that. Beings in samsara are like that. We move around. We go this way, that way. We don't have a rudder. We don't have a map. We don't have a compass. We sort of just, randomly go around from one birth to another one. No sense of direction, nothing going on. And that is the usual problem for beings. And of course, the opposite is when you have a teaching which shows you a way out, and that is what the Dhamma is supposed to be, a teaching which shows you a way out, then you have the map, you have the sense of direction, you have the rudder, and suddenly you can steer a course which actually goes somewhere, rather than just randomly moving around, like the deer, herd of deer normally does. And this herd of deer is then being led by this Mara, the evil one, and I think the main meaning of Mara, the evil one, is basically the inner Mara, Mara of defilements and temptations and all these things which often drive us to do all kinds of things. I think this is the main meaning here of Mara, the evil one. And it lead to our harm, bondage, and ruin. And the false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path. And so this is basically the wrong factors of the Eightfold Path. I won't go too much into what that means, but basically it means not the right factors, right? So for example, take wrong concentration, for example, Samma Samadhi, it means then, at the very least, it means Samma Samadhi, but with wrong view connected to it, or it just means wrong concentration altogether, a completely kind of wrong type of Samadhi. So anything which is not the Eightfold Path, I think, essentially is meant here. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. So this is basically craving, right? You're delighting in something, so you lust for it, or you crave for it, so you go after it. So craving always takes you in the wrong direction. It's a decoy which leads you astray from the right path and leads you in the wrong direction. The dummy is a term for ignorance. Because the dummy is like a... It looks like the real thing, like it looks like one of the deer in the herd, looks like a real deer, but actually it isn't. It isn't actually a real deer. So you're led astray by this dummy, which is just standing there, which is not actually a part of the herd in the first place. In the same way, ignorance, when you don't see things rightly, you think that happiness is over there, but actually it's over here. You think that there's a self over there, but actually there is no self over there. So there's this dummy, there's this kind of blindness which makes you go in the wrong way, just like a dummy makes the herd follow something which is not actually a real deer at all. And then the Tathagata, he is the one who comes along and he opens up the Eightfold Path. In other words, he realizes that the Dhamma, and he destroys ignorance. It says here, he closes off the false path. In other words, he teaches about the wrong Eightfold Path, removes the decoy. In other words, he destroys craving in himself, he destroys the dummy, he makes an end of ignorance, and then he enables the herd of deer to come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. In other words, enabling humanity and even devas to actually practice the right way to make an end of suffering. So that is, it's a nice, beautiful simile there, I find there. So then we come to the end, coming towards the very end of the sutta. So bhikkhus, the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So the Buddha, as it says elsewhere, he shows the way, and he's acting out of compassion. And that is all he does. And then the rest is up to us to do the practice. And of course, he says here very nicely, I have done it out of compassion for you, seeking your welfare and compassion. And this is what I find so beautiful about the suttas. And you feel that there is the only purpose, the Buddha has finished everything he needs to do. He doesn't have anywhere to go anymore. And the only reason he still hangs around, so to speak, is because of compassion for other people. Isn't that wonderful? That's his only reason for existence, is compassion, trying to help others. Now, if that is the only reason for existence, it means that whatever he says, whatever he talks about, you can trust it. So if we know that something is the word of the Buddha, then we know, basically, we can trust this, because he has no other purpose in life than this. Of course, you can probably argue, well, I don't know that he has just compassion. True. But it seems reasonable from the, at least the way the Dhamma is taught. And that is it's a wonderful way of looking at it for sure. So then he says, I have done this out of compassion, and now it's up to you. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Jayati, bhikkhus, meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Meditate, jayati. It's directly related to the word jhana. This is the word for meditation in Pali, jayati. So obviously, when it's so close related to jhana, you know basically what the Buddha, the direction that the Buddha was talking about in meditation becomes quite clear. It talks about calming the mind, making it peaceful, unifying it. This is essentially what meditation is about. And then the vipassana aspect is actually more discursive and happens more when you are often more when you are moving around and reflecting on things, except perhaps the deepest aspects of vipassana. That's how I take this. And do not delay, or else you will regret it later. In other words, when you come to the end of your life and you think back and you think, oh, I had the chance, I didn't take it. I often think that to myself if I don't do something, or I do something which maybe isn't all that useful. Sometimes it comes up to me and I think, oh, I better get my act together and do something here. And because when you die, that is when you reflect on your life, you reflect on what you did. And of course, death happens when you least expect it often. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's word. But before we say anything else, I just want to say what I really like about this sutta is basically the connection between defilements and mindfulness. And you can see here, defilements are overcome by using positive thinking. And then, once they have been overcome, only then is mindfulness really possible. And that is so important to understand, because that is when meditation can take off. Any kind of meditation which is done without real mindfulness is not the real kind of meditation, if you like, the kind of meditation that the Buddha talks about in the suttas. So that is, to me, is a very powerful and important teaching right there. Okay, so I've said plenty enough. So would anybody, does anybody have any questions they want to ask you? Anybody? Everybody happy here? Okay. I've got some questions from the internet here, so if nobody has any questions, I will read out the questions from the internet here. Yeah? Oops. Okay, so so these are the questions. This is from Stephen in Melbourne. How does sensual desire, etc., lead to the affliction of both mine, me and others? I can understand my own affliction, but it's a little harder to see the affliction of others or both. Thanks. Okay, so the reason is because sensual desire distorts your outlook. It distorts your view of the world. When your mind is full of desire, it is clouded. And it is when we are overcome with desire that we, you know, we have infidelity, you know, we're cheating on our partner. That is probably one of the main problems with too much sensual desire. But also lesser things, you know, you buy things that you don't really need. You can actually have a look. If you read in the an earlier sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 14 and also 13, it lists all the problems that often come from sensual desire. Greed leads to conflict. I want to climb the corporate ladder. So does he. Who's gonna get to the higher position? Greed leads to amassing money, sometimes at the expense of others. It leads to robbery. It leads to one country fighting another one. So if you just think about greed, what it does in the big picture, it's not that hard to see that very often it leads to the affliction of others as well. You may think that your greed or your sensual desire isn't that strong, so it's not a problem. And often you are right about that. You would be right about that. But that little spur which is in there, it tends to grow. And eventually, sooner or later, you will do things that you are is not good. It's just only a matter of time. The only way to overcome the harm of sensual desire is to overcome it completely. Then it cannot grow anymore because you have destroyed the root, so to speak. As long as the root is there, it will eventually come back again. So that is that one about the affliction of both myself and others. Okay, then we have from Nelu from Romania. Okay, he says that English is his foreign language for him, or her perhaps. Sometimes it's very hard to understand some words. Ill will comes up. How can I take not understanding without ill will and anger coming up? ill will comes up. How can I take not understanding? Oh, okay, I see. Okay. Okay. Well, I think that one, you just have to remember that, you know, over time you will learn, your English will improve. You just have to be patient with yourself. Don't allow yourself to become angry just because you don't understand, because that just makes it so much worse. So don't try to avoid that. It's of course I can understand that it's frustrating and it's difficult. But just do some metta meditation. Focus on the metta meditation. It is one of the most powerful meditations, in my opinion. And from what you have seen today, because of the importance of overcoming these defilements, because that is so important to actually be able to do meditation in the first place, metta meditation has such an important part of the Buddhist path. Because that is one of the most powerful ways of overcoming these defilements in the long run. So do metta, and if you do metta, then eventually you won't get upset if you can't understand the English language either. Please don't get upset, because that just makes things worse. So just have patience, be careful, take things slowly, and then you will be okay. Please don't get angry with these things. Okay, so last question is from Mel in Chicago, USA. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned the sutta said that our physical body must be well rested, and the mind can go into samadhi easily. But I thought we meditate into certain stage. If meditation depends on the physical body, then it would mean those who are sick would not be able to achieve good meditation. Please explain about the importance of wellness of physical body. Okay, this is really about the middle way, right? Remember the first teaching of the Buddha in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sutta, is the middle way, is the path to achieve awakening. And the middle way means not torturing the body on the one hand, and that includes meditation practice. You don't sit down with lots of pain or lots of problems. You are at ease with the body. Torturing the body doesn't work. The Buddha said that very clearly. On the other hand, you shouldn't indulge the body. The body shouldn't be, you know, so comfortable that you just have wonderful feelings in the body. Because if you have the wonderful feelings in the body, then the mind will be interested in the body, because that is where you find pleasure. If you have pain in the body, the mind will be interested in the body because it will not want the discomfort and the pain. So either way, whether you torment the body or you indulge the body, either way, the body is important. Because the body is important, you won't be able to let it go. Because you can't let it go, you won't be able to meditate with any depth. If you're going to be able to just watch the breath, you have to basically be able to let go of the body first of all. If you can't do that, you won't be able to watch the breath. And part of that is also for the body to be well rested. And because of that, if you go on a meditation retreat, sleep enough. Make sure you really are well rested. In the beginning, if you come from a busy life outside, sleep a little bit extra, you know, for the first couple of days of a long meditation retreat, to make sure that you are really, really well rested. Sometimes people think that the precepts, like the eighth one, about not using a higher luxurious bed, means that you have to sleep on the concrete floor and these kind of things. But be careful, because that, again, tends to go in the direction of tormenting the body. Don't indulge in sleep. Don't torment it. Make sure you're well rested, and then you have the best possible chance of going into deep meditation. That is when mindfulness becomes stronger and meditation becomes possible. Okay, so that is the ones from overseas. Anybody else want to say anything before we call it a day?
Yes, please.
Yes? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
Ajahn, thank you. Yeah. It was just a reflection that we're talking about what we're talking in this sutta, but you haven't related it to, haven't related it so much to the precepts. So that it sort of has a parallel with the precepts. If you don't look after them, then you won't get into much meditation, because you'll always have an agitation if you're not looking after the precepts. Hmm.
Yeah, that's true. Right. It's part of the defilements, right? The precepts really are the first part of subduing the defilements as well. Because the precepts restrain you from doing bad things. You know, the precepts are basically about things that come from defilements, like killing animals or stealing or whatever. It comes from defilement, all of these things. So you are already restraining your defilements. So it's a similar, it fits into that pattern of restraining your defilements, basically. Then, but my point is that it's not enough to do that. It's not enough just to be kind by body and speech or whatever. You actually have to overcome the problem in the mind itself. That is what this is about. Okay, so you start off with the body and speech. Great, wonderful, very, very important, absolutely foundational. But then you have to take it one step further and actually go directly to the mind and work with the mind, overcome the defilements in the mind. And then when you have a pure mind, it's very, very easy to keep the precepts as well. Extra benefit. Yeah. Yes. Okay, anybody else? Everybody happy? Yeah.